from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I just met with my national security team to discuss the situation in Iraq. We've been meeting regularly to review the situation since ISIL, a terrorist organization that operates in Iraq and Syria, made advances inside of Iraq. As I said last week, ISIL poses a threat to the Iraqi people, to the region, and to U.S. interests. So today I want to provide you an update on how we're responding to the situation.
That was U.S. President Barack Obama at a press conference on Thursday, issuing a statement about his intentions in Iraq.
First, we are working to secure our embassy and personnel operating inside of Iraq. As president, I have no greater priority than the safety of our men and women serving overseas. So I've taken some steps to relocate some of our embassy personnel, and we've sent reinforcements to better secure our facilities. Second, at my direction, we have significantly increased our intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets so that we've got a better picture of what's taking place inside of Iraq. And this will give us a greater understanding of what ISIL is doing, where it's located, and how we might support efforts to counter this threat. Third, the United States will continue to increase our support to Iraqi security forces. We're prepared to create joint operation centers in Baghdad and northern Iraq to share intelligence and coordinate planning to confront the terrorist threat of ISIL. And through our new counterterrorism partnership fund, we're prepared to work with Congress to provide additional equipment. We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward. American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well. Fourth, in recent days, we've positioned additional U.S. military assets in the region. Because of our increased intelligence resources, we're developing more information about potential targets associated with ISIL, and going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it. If we do, I will consult closely with Congress and leaders in Iraq and in the region. I want to emphasize, though, that the best and most effective response to a threat like ISIL will ultimately involve partnerships where local forces, like Iraqis, take the lead. Finally, the United States will lead a diplomatic effort to work with Iraqi leaders and the countries in the region to support stability in Iraq. At my direction, Secretary Kerry will depart this weekend for meetings in the Middle East and Europe, where he'll be able to consult with our allies and partners. And just as all Iraqi's neighbors must respect Iraq's territorial integrity, all of Iraq's neighbors have a vital interest in ensuring that Iraq does not descend into civil war or become a safe haven for terrorists. Above all, Iraqi leaders must rise above their differences and come together around a political plan for Iraq's future. Shia, Sunni, Kurds, all Iraqis must have confidence that they can advance their interests and aspirations through the political process rather than through violence. National unity meetings have to go forward to build consensus across Iraq's different communities. Now that the results of Iraq's recent election has been certified, a new parliament should convene as soon as possible. The formation of a new government will be an opportunity to begin a genuine dialogue and forge a government that represents the legitimate interests of all Iraqis. Now, it's not the place for the United States to choose Iraq's leaders. It is clear, though, that only leaders that can govern with an inclusive agenda are going to be able to truly bring the Iraqi people together and help them through this crisis. Meanwhile, the United States will not pursue military options that support one sect inside of Iraq at the expense of another. There's no military solution inside of Iraq, certainly not one that is led by the United States. But there is an urgent need for an inclusive political process, a more capable Iraqi security force, and counterterrorism efforts that deny groups like ISIL a safe haven. In closing, recent days have reminded us of the deep scars left by America's war in Iraq. Alongside the loss of nearly 4,500 American patriots, many veterans carry the wounds of that war and will for the rest of their lives. Here at home, Iraq sparked vigorous debates and intense emotions in the past, and we've seen some of those debates resurface. But what's clear from the last decade is the need for the United States to ask hard questions before we take action abroad, particularly military action. So the most important question we should all be asking, the issue that we have to keep front and center, the issue that I keep front and center, is what is in the national security interests of the United States of America. As Commander-in-Chief, that's what I stay focused on. As Americans, that's what all of us should be focused on. And going forward, we will continue to consult closely with Congress. We will keep the American people informed. We will remain vigilant, and we will continue to do everything in our power to protect the security of the United States and the safety of the American people.
The President's comments were made in response to recent gains by the insurgent group alternately called ISIL, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, and ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The term Levant refers to a geographic region encompassing Syria as well as Cyprus, Israel, Jordan, Lebanon, Palestine, and parts of southern Turkey. The stunning military success of the new insurgency has been used by the Western media and officials in Washington as a measure of failure of the Iraqi government forces. But the insurgents themselves seem extremely well organized and equipped for irregulars. Michael Maloof is a former senior security policy analyst from the Office of the Secretary of Defense. He spoke with RT on Wednesday.
It's a major policy decision now on whether or not there's going to be any U.S. intervention at this point to try and trip them up and cause them to and try to stymie their forward progress, which is basically a blitzkrieg. It's unheard of these days. So there's some weighty decisions that are going to have to be made. But in order to do that, the intelligence has got to be pinpoint accurate, and you've got to find them. I mean, I've noticed the pictures of them traveling in caravans in the open, and you wonder, well, why hasn't anyone done anything about it? But at the same time, they've got some very smart military planners and operators there, and they can adjust. So they can make it much more difficult for us to stop them. And certainly the Iraqi government's having a hard time.
Yeah, and we're also hearing increasingly about the U.S. mulling air attacks. But U.S. military intelligence is reportedly unable to pinpoint these clear targets. Is air power going to be useful in this case?
It can be, because these guys travel over widespread areas. They're on the move, but once they get into a particular area, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult to flesh them out, because then they're mingling in with the civilian population, and that makes it far more difficult, which inevitably means that you would have to have boots on the ground, and the U.S. isn't going to be doing that. So it's going to be up to the Iraqi government to put those boots in the area on the ground, and certainly the United States could send in advisors and trainers, and that's a possibility as well.
While the president promises that he will not send more combat military forces back into Iraq, it appears that thousands of those originally wearing the boots on the ground there have remained and simply changed their shoes. Press TV's Kovi Tavwe has more.
The United States is keeping more than 6,000 security and backup forces in Iraq. Now, sources say these forces are former military members who have remained in the country after changing their official job title. The U.S. military presence in Iraq comes as the Obama administration has recently ordered the urgent deployment of several hundred troops to the troubled country. Washington is said to be after military operations in the Arab country under the pretext of fighting terrorism there. This is while a recent poll by a U.S. firm shows that 74% of Americans oppose sending U.S. forces to Iraq. The U.S. and its allies invaded the country back in 2003, and a couple of years before that, they also invaded Afghanistan under the pretext of fighting terrorism. But over a decade after these invasions, the two war-torn countries are still grappling with rampant militancy and a high humanitarian cost. Washington is also pressing ahead with its drone strikes in the region that has claimed the lives of thousands of civilians in Afghanistan Pakistan, and in Yemen.
The UN hosted a presentation Wednesday which attempted to balance the one-sided coverage of the Syrian presidential election held earlier this month. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bashar Ja'afari, was joined by a group of observers from the U.S. who monitored the June 3rd polling. Press TV's Caleb Maupin reports from New York.
The U.S. delegation of five people joined with hundreds of observers from around the world last week to observe the voting process in the Syrian Arab Republic done in compliance with the new Syrian constitution. The delegation of observers included Joe Eisbacher of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization, Judy Bello of the Fellowship for Reconciliation, Paul LaRudy of the Syria Solidarity Movement, blogger Jane Stillwater, and Scott Williams of Fight Imperialism Stand Together.
My experiences together showed me what I believe these elections represent. They are, number one, a defeat for the United States, for NATO, for the Zionists and the Gulf states, and a victory for the Syrians.
The observers described the massive turnout of Syrians who voted, despite their country being in a complete state of civil war, as a mass campaign of terrorist violence is being waged. Scott Williams told Press TV of how, in addition to the election process, he saw the effects of terrorism on the Syrian people.
Everything is destroyed. Brand new buildings that are just skeletons because of bombs going off. And we see that everywhere. And it's really a shame because Damascus is the oldest city in the world.
After the panelists spoke, Syrian ambassador to the United Nations, Bashar Ja'afari, criticized Western media for its coverage of the Syrian conflict.
Still, too many people in USA and in France and England and elsewhere, they don't even use the term of terrorists to describe these terrorist groups. They call them jihadists, they call them militants, insurgents, revolutionaries, you name it. They never use the term terrorist to describe these entities.
All the observers expressed opposition to the U.S. government's policy in Syria and declared that it was obvious to them that the Syrian government has the support of the overwhelming majority of the population. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
We'll bring you the report from the observers in its entirety later in this newscast. It appears that progress is being made in the P5+1 talks in Vienna. We have this report from Press TV.
Representatives from Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany hold another day of nuclear talks in Austria's Vienna. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, and the EU foreign policy chief, Catherine Ashton, have held a bilateral meeting to discuss the process of drafting a final deal dubbed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. On Wednesday, Zarif said that drafting the deal does not mean that agreement has been reached in all fields. Iran and the P5+1 started the latest round of talks in the Austrian capital on Monday. The five-day negotiations are aimed at settling a decade-long Western dispute over Tehran's nuclear program.
House Republicans elected a new majority leader Thursday, choosing Kevin McCarthy of California, a loyal lieutenant to Speaker John Boehner. McCarthy's ascension to the number two job in the House of Representatives fills the sudden void in the Republican leadership left by Eric Cantor's loss of his seat last week in a Republican primary. Cantor from Virginia was the heir apparent to Boehner and stunned the political establishment by losing by more than 10% to a Tea Party upstart and economics professor, David Brat. The UN hosted a presentation Wednesday attempting to balance the one-sided coverage of the Syrian presidential election held earlier this month. Syria's permanent representative to the UN, Bashar Ja'afari, was joined by a group of observers from the U.S. who monitored the June 3rd election. Ja'afari introduced the American observers at Wednesday's conference.
I'm really thrilled today to introduce to you and to share with you, actually, the experience of a distinguished panel of American observers who participated at overseeing the presidential elections that took place in Syria on June the 3rd. Side by side, of course, with other observers who came from all over the world, too many countries sent observers and monitors to make sure that the presidential elections that took place in Syria were genuine and that these elections applied the international standards of multipartism which is, as you know, a basic pillar of democracy. That was the first experience ever in Syria for quite some time, maybe since the 60s of last century. And this is why this experience is indeed and should be a matter of deep reflection of the journalist accredited to the United Nations as well as to all those who are keen interest in knowing what really happened in Syria. Of course, while speaking about the presidential elections, you may have other questions related to what we call, commonly speaking at the United Nations, the Syrian crisis prevailing right now. All these reflections and questions are legitimate, and I guess, and I'm quite sure, let me say, that our guests will have the appropriate and suitable answers to all these questions. I would like to thank Anka for participating and hosting this this meeting. I hope it will be useful, as expected, of course, by all of us. And my thanks also go to the Secretariat of the United Nations for facilitating the holding of this press conference. The panel of experts and observers include distinguished experts, as I said, Mrs. Judy Bello, welcome, Dr. Paul Laroude, Mr. Joseph Losbaker, and Mrs. Jane Stillwater, and Mr. Scott Williams. Without any delay, I would like and I would prefer to give them the floor so that we give them enough time to give you the right picture of the Syrian landscape that was prevailing during the elections. They are eyewitnesses, and they will tell you about their own experience in this very important event in Syria. Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm Judy Bello, and I'm an anti-war activist and a blogger from upstate New York. I came to Syria to better understand the impact of the Western-backed war on Syria and the Syrian people. I wanted to see firsthand the people's engagement with the election and to hear some stories that I could relate on my blog. And I did bring back some wonderful insights from ordinary people that I'm publishing. Observing the popular support for the Syrian election was a moving experience for me. The people voted with their hearts. Here in the West, there's no impediment to voting, and yet little more than 50% of the population generally vote, and most of us do so out of a sense of obligation. The overwhelming response of people inside and outside of Syria sent a powerful message to the world of loyalty to their country and to the government that is currently safeguarding it. As we all know, Dr. Bashar Assad won the election by a landslide. More important, though, than the 88% of the vote that he won was the 73% of the population who actually voted. Given that there were those who claimed to be boycotting and people in areas too violent to open a voting booth, and that the diaspora in Europe and the United States were barred from voting at local embassies, 73% was a pretty good number for what amounted to a referendum on the president's governance. In fact, it was quite astounding. Those who are prosecuting this war on Syria and their facilitators should understand that their war has not only failed to win the hearts and minds of the people of Syria, but it has failed to break them. And to the people of Syria, I want to say that I wish you peace and a just resolution of your travails and the prosperous future that you deserve. Thank you.
My name is Paul Larudi. I'm a piano tuner, former academic and government advisor from Northern California. I'd like to say that I found the Syrian election to be an extraordinary affirmation of the will of the Syrian people. Although the outcome was never in doubt, Syrians abroad overwhelmed their embassies or flew thousands of miles for the opportunity to vote. In Syria, they came to the polls in vast numbers to demonstrate their support. I observed the election in the city of Homs, where the turnout was huge and enthusiastic, despite threats of attack from the armed opposition. Homs has been called the capital of the revolution, and the center of the city had been freed from opposition control less than a month before the election. Nevertheless, the voting was peaceful and the turnout heavy. It may be useful to compare the Syrian and Egyptian elections. In both cases, the outcome was certain. But in Syria, the turnout was twice as great, even though many of the refugees were unable to vote in other countries, and parts of Syria were in the control of occupation forces. Clearly, the Syrian people intended to send a message that they support their current government. Well, we got that message.
Good morning. My name is Joe Osbaker. I'm an activist with the Anti-War Committee in Chicago, and I'm also part of the leadership of the United National Anti-War Coalition. We are the organization that organized the protest when NATO's summit was held in Chicago. That protest with 15,000 people was the largest anti-war demonstration in the United States since Barack Obama became president. I was one of two national coordinators for that demonstration. I want to say that the Syrian people are truly an inspiration to me. They have withstood this terrible war brought to their country by my government and its allies. I also observed the election in Homs, where the death toll has been in the thousands. And in fact, 1 week after our visit there on election day, 1 week later, there was a car bomb that targeted civilians. And, you know, that was exploded by the foreign-backed right-wing rebels. In one of the polling places, I spoke with a medical student, a 22-year-old woman, who wants to be an ophthalmologist, like her president, Bashar al-Assad. She and her young friends were confident that the Syrian people would go forward and rebuild their country. The U.S. government denounced the election before it was held. And as Paul said, the governments that are behind the war in Syria closed the embassies so Syrians abroad could not participate. But I think the measure of this election was taken when we were in Beirut in the days before the 3rd of June, when hundreds of thousands of Syrians lined up, drove miles, walked miles in order to participate. We met on our first morning with the head of the Electoral Commission in Syria, and he told us that they had only printed 200,000 ballots for Beirut, and they ran out. And the Western media was shocked. They were stunned by these refugees. And these things together, my experiences together, showed me what I believe these elections represent. They are, number one, a defeat for the United States, for NATO, for the Zionists and the Gulf states, and a victory for the Syrians. Thank you.
My name is Jane Stillwater. I was a war correspondent in Iraq with the Marines in Al-Anbar province and also with the Army in Baghdad in the Green Zone. And my statement is here on the press thing, and I think everybody here has said the elections were valid, legitimate, no question. So what I'd like to take this opportunity to address the elephant in the room, ISIS. When I was in Syria,
I found that the Syrians were totally against ISIS and they were totally shocked. And now, on the news here, I'm hearing that the Islamic militants have come out of Syria. First, these aren't Syrians. Syrians fought ISIS. And second, every time I hear Islamic militants, I cringe, because ISIS is not Islamic. The ISIS members, they do not act like Muslims. They are not Muslims. Muslims are compassionate and just, and justice means a lot to them. They are no more Muslims than Hitler was a Christian. Muslims, ISIS main modus operandi in Syria and in Iraq is to move into a city or town, kill or drive out the civilian population, and then loot and slash and burn like pirates. And the same thing happened in Mosul, where apparently the first thing that ISIS and other Islam, quote-unquote Islamic militants did was to loot the central bank of $500 million while flying this black and white Jolly Roger. And ISIS doesn't want to capture Baghdad either. It was after the oil refinery, and it just captured the oil refinery. ISIS doesn't want to convert people to Islam. All they want to do is show me the money. And these are the people that America is backing. And American taxpayers are paying billions to weaponize and train these crooks and robbers. And Bush and Cheney are the blue beards who gave birth to ISIS. And President Obama is no Captain Jack Sparrow either.
Great, thank you. My name is Scott Williams, and I'm an organizer with the International Action Center, and I'm based in Philadelphia. So I visited Syria to observe the 2014 elections, along with ministers of parliament and dignitaries from 32 countries across the world in every continent. And on election day, I observed many polling places across Sweda, which is in the southern part of Syria. What I saw opened my eyes to the reality of war and the resilience of the Syrian people. One of the young women I talked with for quite a while in Sweda described her experience, her everyday experience, with the U.S.-funded war as a daily nightmare. It was like living in a horror movie. She described just brutal scenes. Despite this reality, Election Day in Syria was a nationwide day of celebration, absolutely. On June 3rd, over 9,600 polling places, including in places like Aleppo, were open, and in cities across Syria, thousands of people were in the streets. And we saw this in all the different cities, in Tartus, in Homs, in Damascus, in Sweda, and all across the country where we visited. And these people were proclaiming their own victory with this election. This was a victorious moment. This election was truly an expression of the will of the people of Syria, unlike the fraudulent elections across the region and here in the United States and Europe. The massive turnout of over 73% of all Syrian adults speaks to how millions of people in Syria want peace, democracy, and sovereignty. And no matter how many U.S.-built bombs drop, or no matter how many U.S.-paid mercenaries enter the country, there are now over 11,000 Syrians who are ready to defend their country, and that's what they did peacefully this time by voting in this election. And including actually up to 15 million people, honestly, over 15 million people. Lastly, as a young person growing up in the United States, my entire conscious life has been one of U.S. wars of aggression in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, and now in Syria. And you can mention other countries. Based on watching these events, it is clear to me that the U.S. weapons, troops, and support for regime change and so-called democracy has led to nothing but chaos and misery for millions of people. Despite this, the Syrian people are a tremendous inspiration of how to fight back against this and win.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.